Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 11 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is October 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I'm also speaking at the IFTA conference later on today, so I will try and record that broadcast. I know they'll also be recording it, so I will do my utmost to share that full presentation with subscribers as well. But I thought I'd kick off today with the Hang Seng China Enterprises Index, because it's looking like an upside key reversal, and it's right at the lower side of its range. The mainland Chinese market opened up again in here today, so we had a reasonably firm environment. In fact, it's not actually a key reversal because the close did not close above the high of the previous week, but it's certainly a tail on the candle. We're at the lower side of the range and it's short-term oversold. And then when we think about mainland Chinese shares, they were also in positive territory today, so that's helping to support the view that efforts are underway to try and insulate the wider economy from the bankruptcy of China Evergrande. And the Hang Seng Properties Index also has rebounded from 3,500 to 4,000. Well, that has at least unwound the short-term oversold condition, and now it's pressuring the sequence of lower rally highs. So it would certainly be a benign outcome if the Chinese administration were to announce that they were going to have more substantive efforts or measures underway to manage the fallout from the dissolution of China Evergrande. In many respects, the company does have assets. Now, those assets might not be easily marketable, but they do have a value, and it probably suggests that there will be a reallocation of resources to more than likely state-owned or politically favored companies, and that bondholders are probably going to have to take a hit, and recovery rates on US dollar denominated debt from the perspective of foreign investors remains the great unknown. But every effort will be underway to, or I think undertaken, to ensure that regular consumers get the houses that they paid for. So there are certainly efforts underway to try and limit the knock-on effect of such a large issuer of debt and property developer from going under, and we're already seeing that other highly indebted companies are also going under, with Fantasia being the other example this week. But that only further increases the potential that there will be other efforts underway to make credit available where it is needed. And it's also particularly relevant that the state-sponsored banking sector has also been reasonably well insulated, and it still has the sequence of higher reaction lows, despite the fact that it hasn't really gone anywhere in the last 3 months. That's already a really quite impressive feat. I've put in a 1,000-day moving average just for the for this week in terms of the big picture long-term audio, because we've certainly seen that there's been a significant process of consolidation that's been going on in a significant number of markets. And I think it's particularly relevant to highlight the 1,000-day moving average when we look at secular trends. So Chinese banks really haven't gone anywhere for 6 years, but they have had a very mild upward bias, and that upward bias remains intact. So it does suggest that the Chinese government don't want fireworks from the banking sector. either on the upside or the downside, and they are willing to ensure that they are increasingly viewed as arms of the government. Then, with the mainland markets opening up, the renminbi was trading again in here today and it came through firmer. So, China also wants to dispel any kind of speculation about real stress in the economy by ensuring that the currency is quiet and is continuing to firm here. So, that's also supportive of the wider market. So one of the first inclinations of institutional investors has been to go off and buy Chinese tech companies. So Alibaba is sitting on an upside weekly key reversal and it stands out on the chart and it is higher, closing higher than the highs of the last 2 consecutive weeks. So that does suggest that investors are at their first inclination has been to go after the tech sector for perhaps the same reasons that people went after the tech sector after the credit crisis. That there was going to be a new credit cycle, that the one redeeming feature of the technology sector is that they don't own properties and they're not building properties and they're not engaged in the kind of leverage. That property companies have been engaged in. So, if one had to make a bet about China, one and in a worst case scenario where the property market runs into real trouble, well, then the technology sector is likely to be reasonably well insulated. And then there will also be the clear determination to try and ensure that there's going to be a response at in terms of supplying liquidity to consumers, and then they would benefit from that as well. So Alibaba is firming from the region of the $150 area. And we can also think about the 1,000-day moving average that it had held for a sufficiently long time that it might have been viewed as a possible area of support, and in this case, it was not. So that $150 area is also rather relevant for Baidu because it also pulled back in an extraordinary fashion. Having surged in an extraordinary fashion, it gave up the entire advance and now is also firming from that $150 area. And it's also an upside weekly key reversal following a 4-week decline, but it's a higher reaction low overall. So we do now have evidence of higher reaction lows in some of these instruments. And it would suggest that investors are willing to begin to look past some of the worst of the selling pressure that's happened in China. And even Tencent, which has been, I think, singled out for opprobrium from regulators and saying that computer games are opium for the soul. Obviously that has had an impact on enthusiasm for the share, but it is now also firming, and on this occasion it is firming from the 1,000-day moving average. Of course, it's on Wall Street where we have the clearest evidence of long-term support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So it's been something that is particularly relevant that we get in big secular bull markets that the market does generally not tend to drop below the 1,000-day moving average. And then it pulls away from it in a very significant fashion in the bubbly periods. And this was a particularly lengthy bubbly period between 1994 and 2000. But now we're in another one of those types of situations. We had a big wobble in 2020. And since then, we've had this extraordinary advance where the market has more than doubled. So going from 2200 to 4500 is just a little bit more than a double. And back after the long-term capital management bust in 1998, and then we had a big monetary response to that. Well, then after that, the market went up 68%, and it did it in the space of about 2 years. So in this case, the market has gone up over 100% in a year, and now we're in the region of the trend mean once more. So we've had a reasonably consistent advance with ranges one above another, and now we're testing the upper side of the most recent one of those ranges. So it's a rather interesting area where near-term support should start to be reasserted. And considering how quickly we've gone up, then a reversion back down to the 1,000-day moving average would more than likely represent a peak of more than near-term significance and potentially the end of a secular bull market. So this is the time really where the 200-day moving average will need to be reasserted, because we're at much higher valuations now, and we have much more greater interest rate sensitivity in the market, and that's most particularly relevant for unprofitable companies. So the Nasdaq 100 has been particularly consistent on the upside, despite the speed of the advance up off the lows in March of 2000, of 2020, excuse me. The index has continued to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average on successive occasions, and each of the ranges have been reasonably similar sized, and they've been one above another with only very mild dips on an intraday or intra-week basis into the underlying ranges. So now we can just think about what's going on now. So we've had a reaction from peak to trough of approximately 1,316 points, and that is smaller than we've had already. If it were to pull back by, say, the full 1,700 to 1,800 points, well, then we would be somewhere down around the 13,600 area and briefly pulling back into the underlying range. Well, it's at exactly that point we should anticipate support coming back in, if the trend is to remain consistent. And this, of course, is the very big question. The weightings on the Nasdaq 100 are extremely dominated by the Fangman shares. And of course, there are a number of the Chinese companies are also among the largest constituents of that index. So both I think it was Baidu and another one of the Chinese companies were the better performer, JD.com, were the better performers in here today on the Nasdaq 100. So in many respects, it's both an index of the largest US companies, but then most of the large Chinese companies as well, with the exception of Alibaba and Tencent. The Fangman group of companies, which is Facebook, Apple, Nvidia, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Netflix, they've now got a market cap in the region of about 10 trillion, and it's been pausing. And it's been a one-way bet, because if one had simply been buying the those seven shares for the last decade, then you could comfortably have outperformed the wider market. And that trade persisted all the way through until the middle of 2020. So it went up in a very consistent manner, and it continually found support in the region of the 200-day moving average all the way along. And then it stopped doing that for a while in late 2020 and early 2021, and now it's back above the trend mean. So it's been up and down in here this week with a bit of a rebound taking place on Wall Street. But the big question then is, We have these companies that are worth trillions. And where's the next double going to come from? Well, I remember asking that question 18 months ago. We had the big answer to that, and it was we had massive monetary and fiscal accommodation as a result of the pandemic panic. And now the big question is, where's the next one going to come from? Because if we do get additional massive monetary accommodation, well, then it would be reasonable to anticipate that these shares will continue to benefit because they have been the lightning rods for speculation and for capital to be thrown at them because they have demonstrated that they can make best use of it. So they've not only been able to attract capital, but they've rewarded investors by being productive with it. And then, of course, they've been granted these high valuations. So when we think about companies, and the most profitable companies in the world are still trading on a price to sales ratio of 7, which isn't really, in the greater scheme of things, when interest rates are 0, 7 probably doesn't sound all that bad. When we think about Google, again, it's an incredibly impressive company, and its price to sales ratio is 8.6. Microsoft, having adopted the subscription business model, has been richly rewarded, and now its price to sales ratio is at 13. So it's not to say that when we look at these trends, that we have any evidence that the trend is in fact over. And Microsoft rebounded in an impressive manner this week, and it still has the succession of higher reaction lows, and it still has little ranges, and they're mostly one above another. And it's rebounded this time from above the trend mean. So it's not to say that we have top formation characteristics yet. But we do have evidence that there's been a loss of these companies have had a loss of their ability to deliver relative strength. So, even though one could have benefited enormously from owning these companies over the course of the last decade, they are not performing now. They're not leading the advance in the stock market at present. So, then on a relative basis, they're less likely to be able to attract the same amount of capital. So, it's an important consideration. Now, if interest rates continue to rally, we're likely to see a question being asked of small caps. Smaller cap companies generally rely more on access to liquidity. So they need the access to liquidity, and then they go off and they try to grow as fast as they can. And they often remain unprofitable for a fairly lengthy period of time until they reach sufficient size and market share to be able to, in fact, make profits. So, low interest rates do definitely help to support small caps, and higher interest rates act as a headwind. So, the Russell 2000 has been going sideways now for most of the last, for most of this year. And at the same time, the high yield sector has been extremely well bid. So high yield spreads are still only at about 250 basis points. There is absolutely no evidence of stress in the high yield sector. So that's acting as a fundamental support for the small cap sector. And it's generally being viewed as a positive overall for the wider economy, that we have not yet had a big cycle of bankruptcies. And even though the moratoriums on evictions have mostly ended, there hasn't been a massive surge in bankruptcies and in evictions just yet, but it is also worth reminding ourselves that these things take time. And the bankruptcy and most particularly the eviction cycle didn't really start to really pick up pace after the credit crisis into until, excuse me, until well into 2011-12. So that is potentially on the horizon. And then we can think about the 5-year yield, because the 5-year yield approximates the duration of the US government debt, and it's now cruising through 1%. And this is a dynamic move this week, and it clearly illustrates that the cost of servicing the debt in the USA is going to rise. And it's up from 0.2 of 1% to over 1% in the space of a year. In other words, the yield has quintupled. Now, of course, we're coming off extraordinarily low levels. So it also helps to highlight here that the cost of servicing the debt has been extraordinarily has been rising for a prolonged period, and then it really took off with the Trump tax cuts. Well, because the size of the debt was so large, and because the yield compressed so incredibly, well, then we saw that in 2020, the debt actually contracted. And that took an awful lot of pressure off of governments. So we had this massive spike in the supply of bonds, and the total debt for the US federal government increased substantially in 2020. So we had this jump in the total cost or in the total debt, and then we had the cost of servicing that debt decline. But that was on the assumption that these interest rates were going to remain low. And if we were just to take the highs for 2020, well, then we've had a doubling. So we'd have to anticipate that the cost of servicing the debt has already increased substantially, and that it is likely to increase further the higher these yields go. So that's going to cut into spending plans. And there's still already a lot of horse trading around how big the deficits are going to be, what the spending plans that can eventually pass through Congress will actually be, whether there's going to be an infrastructure bill at all. And there's going to be a lot of horse trading by the time we come around to December. And in that time, yields are continuing to rise. And it's also worth reminding ourselves that CPI inflation is 5.2% right now. It hasn't been that high since before 2007. Excuse me, before 2008, sorry. And that was, of course, during the inflationary push as oil prices started to really rally and pull everything higher in the preceding years up to the peak in 2008. So we're definitely seeing inflationary pressures coming through. And it's easy to look at all the people that are protesting on the streets, and everything from the BLM movement to the to kids that are destroying school property to get clout on social media, to strike action. Well, all of these are indicative of populations that are looking for better living conditions. And it's clearly inflationary that when people start to ask for more money for doing the same amount of work, well, then it lowers productivity and it contributes to inflationary pressures. So We've had plenty of that over the course of the last while. And I find it particularly interesting that it's the kinds of instruments that do well in an inflationary environment have been breaking out to new highs. So the financials ETF, it was at a new high this week. The commodities complex, regardless of which portion of it one looks at, whether it is agriculture, where you have Mosaic rallying in an impressive manner for 3 consecutive weeks. So that is now breaking the sequence of lower rally highs. It's completing this base formation, and it's been going down for what feels like an awful long time. So we have commodity prices, particularly food prices, that are pushing on the upside. And the major food commodities are also all steady. So wheat prices are north of $7. So that's not quite a double from the lows in 2019, but we're not all that far away from it either. Soybeans are a major food commodity for most of Asia and a major commodity for the agricultural sector as well. And prices are now back in the region of $12. But this looks like more of a consolidation than a major top formation. Palm oil prices are pushing on the upside. So that's a major ingredient in a whole raft of different products. And it broke out to new all-time highs this week. So this is a really emphatic move, and it suggests that there is significant supply inelasticity. And we had incredible fireworks in the natural gas markets. So UK natural gas is starting to come back down, but it was at £400 this week. So, and it's not even showing it, the scale can't accommodate how high the price went for a brief period in here this week. So this was a spectacular acceleration. And now Europe is increasingly beholden to Russia. And they are going to have to sign up to long-term contracts. But one of the, I think, the logical inconsistencies that this whole episode has helped to highlight is that if you really do believe in climate change, then you cannot invest in energy alternatives that depend on the climate remaining constant. Because if you're worried, for example, about the North Atlantic drift or the Gulf Stream losing power, well, then that kills off wind to most of Northern Europe. I grew up in the southwest of Ireland, and it was very seldom that there wasn't a windy day. And I thought it was hilarious when I started bringing my daughter to rowing practice in Dallas that they don't go out on the lake when there's a wave. And Dallas is a pretty windy place, but they don't go out on the lake rowing if there's a wave of more than about 4 inches. And we would go out on the lake if before there was a wave of a foot, and we'd still be going, because if you didn't go, you'd never get to go. Of course, we also had a much bigger lake, but the reality is that those winds off the in places like Ireland and the UK and in Scandinavia, they're all as a result of the Gulf Stream. And if the worst prognostications of the environmentalists are true, and that the Gulf Stream will weaken, well, then not only will Northern Europe get colder, but there'll be fewer windy days. And that's not such great news for the wind sector. So, wind is now starting to come back down. And this is also about interest rates, because when you go off and you build some of these pieces of infrastructure, Well, then it's done on credit, and it takes a while to build them. And until they're built, you don't get any income. So you need low interest rates, and you need basically free money so that you can go off and build these pieces of infrastructure, whether those are going to be solar panels or concentrating solar farms or whether it is wind turbines. And then the reliability and the quantity of energy that comes off of them is entirely weather dependent. But if the entire reason for building them was because of weather volatility, then betting that the weather isn't going to change when the reason you built it is because the weather is changing doesn't make a lot of sense. So there's going to have to be additional and significant additional investment in electricity generation. And it's not just because of wind and solar, it's because of electric vehicles. So Tesla's success in continuing to break its own estimates of deliveries, that only further emphasizes that we're going to have more electric vehicles. There were more electric vehicles than diesel vehicles sold in Europe last quarter. This isn't the first time that's happened, and the supply of diesel vehicles has been contracting for at least the last 5 years. But there are still hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of diesel vehicles being sold. We are, though, starting to see platinum starting to perform, and it rallied today to break the sequence of lower rally highs since the peak back in January of this year. So that's beginning to look more encouraging, and platinum is more of a metal associated with diesel, for one thing, which of course is completely weather independent, and those engines are extremely reliable. And one would have to think that, just on a common sense way of thinking about things, wouldn't the money be better deployed trying to come up with a cleaner diesel engine than trying to re-engineer the entire global supply chain for energy to provide for intermittent supply? But that's obviously not a decision that we get to make. Palladium prices have also started to steady, so that's also helping to support the view that perhaps automotive production will start to tick upwards once more. We've seen that automotive production has been under pressure because they haven't had access to the semiconductors, but now we're starting to see palladium firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. We've had a meaningful pullback, and this was a big upward dynamic in here this week. Silver prices have also begun to steady, and it has pulled back in a rather dynamic manner and pushed to a new reaction low. It also found support in here this last week, really, in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. I remain very much of the view that this is a first step above the base, and these first steps above the base, they can be lengthy and volatile and maddeningly so from the perspective of the longer-term investor. But as long as the price is holding the $20 area, well, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And gold continues to pause here around the $1,750 area. It did pop on the upside today as a result of the weak employment figures. But the thing that I think is most relevant is we can think about why do people own gold, and we can also think about why hasn't it done better, and why is it so quiet when we have so many different themes and forces tugging at various asset prices. And it's easy to just think that Bitcoin is robbing it of impetus, and that there's a lot more interest in the promise of juicy returns from cryptocurrencies than there is from gold, so people aren't investing in it in the same way as they might normally. And there might be some rationale to justify that. The bigger rationale is that stocks are still going up. So you don't have to buy gold because you have other alternatives. And interest rates are rising. And there's a certain inevitability about this, that the higher interest rates go, the greater the pressure will come to bear on the unprofitable companies. And that will start to have a negative effect on high yield. And that will then translate into a more difficult time for the wider market, but most particularly for the growth sector. And when the growth sector is not just underperforming on a relative basis, but underperforming in an absolute way, well, then that is when people will really start to look at alternatives. And then there is this big question circulating about the role of Tether in the cryptocurrency markets. So we've had a meaningful run higher in Bitcoin over the course of the last 2 weeks, and it's gone from $40,000 to $55,000. So that's a significantly large move, and it has taken out the peak from early September. So it's a higher high, and we have a higher low. So we're in the region of the peak from back in March. It's an interesting place to start thinking about the future. So at the moment, Bitcoin is cannibalizing the rest of the cryptocurrency universe, and its market cap relative to the wider crypto market is increasing. So that's being driven by a number of different factors. The first is that there's going to be Taproot innovation released onto the market in November. So there's at least some buying in advance of that. And that will allow smart contracts on top of the Bitcoin blockchain, which would make it competitive with things like Ethereum, for example. So that's a net positive, and it's helping to attract interest. Well, then we also have the additional questions about regulation. And in this case, size probably does matter. And the 6,000 other cryptocurrencies, where maybe 80% of them are really on a very dodgy ground in terms of the rationale behind them or the extent to which they're anything other than money-grabbing exercises. So there's the potential that a lot of those are going to either get banned or lose their interest in them entirely, which would then, of course, concentrate additional interest in the bigger coins. So there is certainly an element of that as well. But then there's also the potential that what we're seeing is Tether being used, or there's efforts underway to support the Tether network, and that money being poured into Bitcoin is there to ensure that Tether doesn't suffer the equivalent of a margin call. Because Tether is used as the currency that many market participants use to interact with the Bitcoin network. And they have got this huge position in commercial paper. And I thought that the IMF the graphic yesterday was really quite illustrative, because it, in no uncertain terms, helped to highlight just where the bodies are buried. So Tether has got more than half of its reserves in commercial paper. But nobody knows what commercial paper there is. And then you can think about US dollar coin, where most of the money is in the is in treasury bills and cash deposits, and they've only got maybe 20% of their reserves in some kind of commercial paper. Binance is almost all in bank deposits, and then DAI has most of its reserves in another cryptocurrency. So at least one of them looks like a money market fund, but it's by no means the largest. And the largest has got this enormous speculative position. And there's the real possibility, and rumors have been flying, that what they own is China Evergrande's paper. So that represents an existential threat in the short term to the cryptocurrency markets. And it simply can't be ruled out that there's going to be a significant loss of confidence in the sector. And that might only be short term, and it might be used by some other well-heeled investors to buy the dip. But it also helps to expose that this is an extraordinarily unregulated sector, and it really helps to highlight what exactly unregulated means. So, at least with gold, you know what you are getting. And I think that is perhaps, it might seem prosaic at present, but it's certainly something that is likely to be increasingly important as we go further down the road of this bull market overall. Well, the other thing, of course, is that when we think about Europe and we think about Japan, well, they trade on lower valuations. And lower valuations only really become important when you have higher interest rates and inflation. And the Euro Stoxx index has completed a very lengthy range, and it's right back in the region of the upper side of, well, in dollar terms, in the upper side of the long-term range. In local currency terms, it broke out to a new all-time high. When we think about the TOPIX index in Japan, it's clearly broken out of a very lengthy range. It's still away from the peak put in what feels like an awfully long time ago, but it looks like it has completed this base formation. So these lower valuation markets should do better. Then we can think about the fact that commodity prices are rallying, oil prices are above $80, lithium is making new highs. Copper continues to lead this commodity bull market. Nickel is starting to push on the upside, and the producers of commodities should benefit in that environment. So, Brazil was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today and firming from the lower side of its range. Commodity-related currencies outside of the developed markets have been especially weak, and the Real was weaker as well in here this week, but it's at least beginning to put some support in around with lows around the six. And we are miles away from a decade of appreciation. So if oil prices continue higher, if iron ore prices begin to recover, if copper continues to push higher and agricultural commodities continue to do well, then that's going to lend support to some of these emerging markets. The Russian ruble has also been weak over the course of the last few years, but it is strengthening. So there's the potential here that commodity-related currencies are going to begin to attract a lot more interest, and its commodity-related markets are raising interest rates, and they look to be more credible in their efforts to raise rates. And the Australian dollar, for example, has been easing back this year, and not least because of the effect on the domestic economy of the lockdowns in Melbourne and Sydney. But the current account surplus is surging on the upside, exports are doing phenomenally well, and the pandemic will end. And I think these are perhaps the big changes that we're seeing. And it would be easy to talk about the promise of technology and all of the exciting things that are happening in the technology sector, but it's very interest rate dependent. And without some surety on exactly what's going to happen in terms of those interest rates, well, then looking at valuations and looking at where the big uptrends already are, well, then it means that we're probably more back in a commodity and bank-led bull market rather than speculation and technology. And the dollar has been the linchpin of the continued outperformance of Wall Street, and it remains reasonably well bid and continues to hold this advance. Well, as long as that remains the case, then Wall Street's likely to remain fairly steady and could even continue to push higher. But if the dollar starts to pull back, and if we continue to see an inability by the Federal Reserve to raise rates, and I do think that in the short term there's a risk that the Federal Reserve will go ahead with tapering, and they might even try to taper quicker than they've been talking about, and they will be rewarded with some significant stress in the stock market. Now, then, if they pull back and make credit more available, well, then we move back into a more trendy environment on Wall Street. But if the Federal Reserve follows through with interest rate hikes, then the interest rate sensitive portion of the market is going to have a lot of difficulty, and we'll have a very significant rotation away from the techie sector and more towards stronger balance sheets and quality rather than growth overall. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.